The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled From Resistance to Resilience in RRCLL, Sequencing Strategies for Achieving Effective Continuous Care. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/WBS860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hi, my name is Megan Thompson from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, New York. I want to welcome everyone to this unique activity today, exploring sequential treatment strategies with BTK inhibitor options in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Before we begin, let's start with a brief look at where we stand with modern therapy in CLL and several unmet medical needs. So here on this slide, you see covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitor options. And these drugs really now represent core treatment options for both the treatment-naive CLL patients requiring therapy and also in the relapse refractory setting. So there's three covalent BTK inhibitors that are now FDA approved in CLL/SLL. These include ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib. And then there's the non-covalent BTK inhibitor pirtobrutinib, which was FDA approved in December of 2023 for patients receiving two or more prior lines of therapy, including a BTK inhibitor and BCL2 inhibitor. There's also ongoing clinical trials of other non-covalent BTK inhibitors, including nemtabrutinib, which is being tested in the phase 3 BellWave trial. This slide shows some real-world data and really highlights that despite advances in therapies for patients, we do need further research and better sequential management for patients with CLL. So this is data that looks at the Flatiron Electronic Health Record database, over 1,000 patients with CLL, and looks at patients who had received a previous covalent BTK inhibitor and then received venetoclax-based therapy. And we do see that there's still room for improvement looking at the overall survival of these patients after covalent BTK inhibitor and then treated with venetoclax. And this is compared to some of the clinical trial data, for example, the Murano study of venetoclax rituximab in the relapse setting didn't include a lot of these patients. And so this is really valuable data that highlights that we need to really do more research in terms of sequencing of therapy and developing novel therapies for these patients. Here you see outcomes for double exposed and double refractory CLL patients. So double refractory CLL patients being defined as patients previously treated with a covalent BTK inhibitor and venetoclax who were refractory to this treatment. And double exposed is patients who've received those drugs but are not necessarily refractory or progressing on those drugs. And you can see in general on the left, the median progression-free survival of the double refractory patients is less than those of the double exposed. And then there's also data for overall survival, which was not reached in the double exposed patient population. Here are our goals for today. We're going to augment your knowledge of the mechanistic selectivity and safety differences among covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitors, enhance your skills for capturing prognostic factors that can inform sequential treatment planning with BTK inhibitors in relapse CLL, augment your ability to develop personalized sequential treatment plans with covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitors, and improve your skills in team-based care coordination, dosing, and safety management, as well as provision of patient education. So let's get started by reviewing covalent and non-covalent BTK inhibitor binding mechanisms. The covalent BTK inhibitors are drugs such as ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib. These drugs bind covalently to BTK and form an irreversible bond. In contrast, the non-covalent BTK inhibitors include pirtobrutinib and nemtabrutinib. These bind non-covalently with a reversible binding to BTK. So covalent BTK inhibitors to delve further bind irreversibly to BTK. This leads to inhibition of BTK activation and downstream B cell receptor signaling, which we know is a driver of B cell proliferation. Now, with the covalent BTK inhibitors, we've seen in patients who progress on covalent BTK inhibitor therapy, and there's the most data for this with ibrutinib, that mutations in BTK can form at the cysteine 481 site. These are acquired mutations that develop on therapy and prevent binding of the covalent inhibitor drug to the BTK target. These confer resistance to covalent inhibitors, including ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib. And we know that BTK resistance mutations are a major driver of progression. So here you see research looking at ibrutinib discontinuation over four prospective studies. And we highlight here the different events, including progression. There's a lot of data now that it does look like BTK cysteine 481S mutations acquired in most patients after progression on ibrutinib for CLL. These mutations have also been observed, for example, with acalabrutinib, and they really prevent covalent inhibitors from effectively inhibiting their target. So looking at now at pirtobrutinib, the non-covalent inhibitor, again, non-covalent inhibitors bind reversibly to BTK. So pirtobrutinib, I want to highlight, binds reversibly to the BTK protein, and pirtobrutinib has clinical activity in patients with both wild-type BTK, so patients without a pre-existing BTK resistance mutation, as well as in patients who have a BTK cysteine 481S mutation, for example, a patient previously treated with ibrutinib who acquires a BTK resistance mutation in cysteine 481, pirtobrutinib is able to overcome that resistance. So now let's talk about BTK inhibitor selectivity. So what are the implications of selectivity for off-target effects, and how does this translate into safety and adverse events seen in our patients? So here you see a kinome plot for ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib, three covalent BTK inhibitors. And we see on the right that there's potential for off-target effects. So for example, with ibrutinib, there's TEC kinase activity, and this has been shown to be part of the mechanism for increased risk of bleeding and cardiac toxicity, as well as EGFR effects, rash, diarrhea, and arthralgia. Head-to-head trials of ibrutinib versus acalabrutinib and ibrutinib versus zanubrutinib have confirmed the hypothesis that a more selective BTK inhibitor that's more selective for the BTK target has fewer off-target effects. And this has shown to have less toxicity for the second generation covalent inhibitors compared to ibrutinib. So here you see data from ELEVATE-RR. This is a head-to-head randomized trial of acalabrutinib versus ibrutinib in relapsed CLL. And you see here that there are key secondary endpoints, including atrial fibrillation and atrial flutter, and there's less atrial fibrillation and flutter seen with acalabrutinib compared to ibrutinib, less hypertension seen, and less bleeding seen. And importantly, treatment discontinuations due to AEs occurred in 21.3% of patients treated with ibrutinib versus 14.7% of patients treated with acalabrutinib, showing overall a toxicity profile favoring the more selective second-generation BTK inhibitor acalabrutinib. Here is data from the Alpine study. This is a randomized head-to-head comparison of the covalent BTK inhibitors zanubrutinib, a more selective inhibitor, compared with ibrutinib. And here you see that treatment discontinuations because of AEs occurred in 19.8% of patients treated with zanubrutinib compared to 26.2% of patients treated with ibrutinib. With regards to selected AEs of special interest, atrial flutter was less with zanubrutinib compared to ibrutinib. There did appear to be similar rates of hypertension between zanubrutinib and ibrutinib, and similar rates of bleeding between zanubrutinib and ibrutinib. So we see selectivity of non-covalent BTK inhibitors compared to ibrutinib as well. And really, we see that pirtobrutinib appears to be a very selective BTK inhibitor. So pirtobrutinib is now FDA approved in the relapse setting for CLL, and it does appear to be more selective for BTK compared with ibrutinib, although we don't have any head-to-head evidence yet available to see how this will play out in the clinical setting. But to date, the safety profile of pirtobrutinib has been very promising. Overall, a low rate of BTK-associated adverse events of special interest, which you see here on the slide, and 282 patients with CLL treated with pirtobrutinib in the relapse setting in the Bruin study, you can see that AEs, including hemorrhage, were rare at a grade 3 or higher RET level. Atrial fibrillation, only 1.8% all-cause AEs, grade 3 or higher. Hypertension, 4.3% grade 3 or higher for all-cause AEs. And so overall, a very favorable safety profile here. And there is an upcoming study, Bruin CLL 314, that will compare pirtobrutinib, a non-covalent BTK inhibitor, with the covalent inhibitor ibrutinib in treatment-naive CLL. So this ongoing study, when it reads out, will give us an idea about the safety profile of the non-covalent inhibitor pirtobrutinib compared with ibrutinib. So let's start with a case. Scott is an 80-year-old man who presents with symptomatic CLL in 2020. He has B symptoms, drenching night sweats, and weight loss. His comorbidities, including hypertension and mild COPD. He has a white blood cell count of 250,000, a hemoglobin of 9, and platelets of 70. His prognostic testing shows unmutated IGHV status, a deletion 17 by FISH, and a P53 mutation on next-generation sequencing. He started on a acalabrutinib 100 milligrams BID. He's on treatment until March of 2024 when he progresses with B symptoms and splenomegaly. He's now 84 years old with a performance status of 2. So what additional prognostic tests should be performed as we prepare for the next line of therapy? So it's important to highlight that cytogenetic testing, for example, FISH testing for deletion 17P, should also be performed at the time of relapse and prior to selection of each next line of therapy, because there can be acquired genetic abnormalities in CLL, and this is important to know before each line of treatment. However, I will highlight that testing for IGHV mutational status does not need to be retested because IGHV mutational status does not change over time. So here we see some of the testing that should be performed prior to treatment and at the time of relapse prior to each line of therapy for patients with CLL. So I'll highlight FISH testing for deletion 17P, repeat that testing at each relapse. DNA sequencing for P53 mutation should be repeated prior to each line of therapy. IGHV status does not need to be repeated if previously done, as this does not change over time. Cytogenetics, however, can change over time, so karyotype testing, if available, should be performed to assess for complex karyotype and other cytogenetic abnormalities between each line of treatment. So we're going to delve into a case here. We have our patient, Paul. He's 75 years old, and he was started on acalabrutinib in 2019. His baseline testing revealed unmutated IGHV status, and he did not have a deletion 17P on FISH testing. So he's been on acalabrutinib 100 milligrams BID treatment, and in 2024, he comes to clinic with fevers, drenching sweats, and splenomegaly. Repeat fish testing is performed and confirms no deletion of 17P at this time. Should we test for BTK resistance mutations? So it's important to highlight that the resistance mutations, including mutations in BTK or the downstream PCL gamma 2 as part of the signaling pathway, or BCL2 mutations, for example, in patients treated with venetoclax, may be performed to gather information and can be confirmatory for patients with clinical progression, but it's not currently standard of care. And these mutations, for example, BTK cysteine 481 mutations, may develop prior to clinical progression, and mutations alone are not an indication to switch therapy. So I want to emphasize that although we have resistance testing available and prognostic testing, which should be performed prior to each line of therapy, the decision to change a treatment is clinical. It's based on clinical factors outlined by the IWCL criteria. So that can be progressive adenopathy, lymphocytosis with lymphocyte doubling time being rapid, splenomegaly that's progressive on therapy, the development of constitutional symptoms, worsening cytopenias and marrow involvement, as signified by neutropenia, anemia, or thrombocytopenia that is new or worsening. So it really should be a clinical decision when switching therapy. Acquired resistance to bruton and other BTK inhibitors, we know, is generally driven by mutations, and for ibrutinib, this is in BTK at the cysteine 481 site. These are mutations at the binding site of the drug, and in a smaller proportion of patients, there's mutations in PLC gamma 2, which is downstream of BTK. These are identified in the majority of patients progressing on the BTK inhibitor ibrutinib, and there's other resistance mutations that may have a role and ongoing research in this area. So I think it's useful to review where resistance testing really fits into the clinical management of CLL patients. So testing for BTK mutations at the time of progression on a BTK inhibitor may be helpful to confirm resistance. But I should note that low VAF mutations or variant allele frequency mutations are often associated with disease progression on ibrutinib. And this has led to some question whether these mutations fully explain clinical resistance or whether there's other mechanisms and factors at play. Testing for BTK mutations at the time of progression on a BTK inhibitor or BCL2 mutations at the time of progression on venetoclax as screening for resistance is not currently recommended as standard of care. These are tests that can provide additional information, and they may be useful in patients with disease progression or no response while on BTK inhibitor therapy, but it's really the clinical status of the patient that should determine and drive treatment. And I should highlight that BTK and PCL gamma 2 mutations can be present prior to clinical progression, and the mutation status alone should not be used to determine whether a patient's treatment should be changed. That's a clinical decision. This is data from the Bruin study. And when you see here that patients with CLL in the post-covalent BTK inhibitor setting had responses to pirtobrutinib regardless of their BTK mutational status. So this is divided into BTK cysteine 481 wild type or BTK wild type mutations, or patients with a BTK cysteine 481 mutation present. And you can see here no difference in the progression-free survival with overlapping curves. So I want to turn here to a case of relapsed CLL. We have Emily, and she was 70 years old when she was diagnosed with CLL, and she was symptomatic at the time of diagnosis in 2017. She also has a diagnosis of diabetes, and at baseline had unmutated IGHV status, but no deletion of 17P and no P53 mutation. She was treated initially with ibrutinib, but then progressed after 5 years of treatment, and venetoclax rituximab was recommended. However, she progresses and 9 months following end of treatment for fixed duration venetoclax rituximab. So is this a case of double refractory CLL? And what are the treatment options here? Is this a case where retreatment with a venetoclax-based regimen would make sense, or a non-covalent BTK inhibitor? So I want to review some definitions. Double exposed is CLL that has relapsed after exposure to both a covalent inhibitor and venetoclax. Well, double refractory disease is relapsed CLL after progression on both a covalent inhibitor and venetoclax. So there are some questions that still need to be considered when we talk about refractory versus exposed. And one of those is the treatment duration between, for example, someone who completes venetoclax, has a treatment-free remission, and then is a candidate for further therapy. So progression in less than 2 years or 24 months has been suggested as the time interval that would define someone who's double exposed or double refractory with venetoclax, but we really need more data to define what double refractory means with fixed duration venetoclax-based therapy. So here are the current guidelines for patients with CLL, and this is without a del17p or p53 mutations. And retreatment with venetoclax is listed in the relapse setting as useful in certain circumstances for patients who relapse after a prior period of remission. And we also see pirtobrutinib as an option for patients with resistance or intolerance to prior covalent BTK inhibitor therapy. In the current guidelines, pirtobrutinib is also recommended in the post-covalent BTK inhibitor and double exposed setting when a p53 aberrancy is present. Here's retrospective data that supports venetoclax retreatment. And this shows that patients received an initial venetoclax-based regimen and then were retreated with a venetoclax-based regimen in a later line of therapy. And it showed an overall response rate of about 80% to venetoclax retreatment. This was a very heavily pretreated patient population. Over half of patients had a prior BTK inhibitor exposure. And we found a median progression-free survival of 25 months for patients for venetoclax retreatment for patients. There was a median of 16 months between the completion of the initial venetoclax-based regimen and the start of venetoclax retreatment. And there's many ongoing prospective studies that will examine venetoclax retreatment. And I'll highlight here below some studies that are ongoing, and more data will hopefully soon be available for venetoclax retreatment and for patients who received the initial venetoclax in the frontline setting. So here you see data from the Bruin study. These are relapsed CLL patients, and the data here is shown for patients previously treated with a BTK inhibitor. You see the waterfall plot below that shows an overall response rate that is quite high. The dark blue shows patients who discontinued the prior BTK inhibitor for progression, while the lighter blue shows patients who discontinued the prior BTK inhibitor for a toxicity or another reason. And there are responses in both groups. For patients previously treated with a BTK inhibitor, the overall response rate was 82%. And it was 79% for patients treated with a prior BTK inhibitor and prior BCL2 inhibitor. Longer follow-up from the Bruin study confirms a progression-free survival that is quite good for patients previously treated with a covalent BTK inhibitor. So again, the overall response rate for this subgroup is 82%. And here you see the progression-free survival at a median follow-up of 27.5 months. There's a progression-free survival of 19.4 months. Here we see data from the Bruin study based on prior BCL2 inhibitor therapy exposure. So in patients who were previously exposed to a BCL2 inhibitor, the median progression-free survival was 15.9 months. And in patients who were not exposed previously to a BCL2 inhibitor, the median progression-free survival was 23 months. Here we summarize recommendations for treatment sequencing in CLL. So second and third line therapy really depends on what the patient received in prior lines of therapy. So you can see, for example, a patient starting off in the first line with covalent BTK inhibitor therapy. Second line option is standard of care, a venetoclax-based regimen. But non-covalent BTK inhibitors can also be considered when assessing the patient's comorbidity and patient preference. In the third line setting for this subgroup of patients, again, the prior treatment really dictates the current treatment options, as well as treatment-free remission for patients who received a venetoclax plus rituximab or venetoclax plus other anti-CD20 antibody, what treatment-free remission they had after end of treatment can determine whether venetoclax retreatment is an option or switching to a different mechanism of action. Similarly, for patients treated with venetoclax in the frontline setting, second-line options can be a covalent BTK inhibitor, or if the patient had a treatment-free remission that was durable, retreatment with venetoclax plus or minus an anti-CD20 antibody is an option. And then for patients who receive a fixed duration doublet combination, covalent BTK inhibitor plus venetoclax, we really have limited data at this time. Retreatment is being explored in clinical trials, and similar approaches can be considered based on their prior response and treatment-free remission. So here we have a patient, Robert. He's 58 years old, and he was initially diagnosed with CLL back in 2015 when he was asymptomatic. After a period of active observation, he had symptomatic disease in 2021, and he was started on first-line treatment with venetoclax plus obinutuzumab, a one-year treatment course with a one-year remission after end of treatment. He then required therapy again due to clinical progression and was started on acalabrutinib. He was on a dose of acalabrutinib 100 milligrams BID, and 1 year after initiating treatment, he discontinued due to AEs, including arthralgias and fatigues. And these interventions for AEs were not successful. And so what are his treatment options now? Can he transition to an alternative BTK inhibitor, venetoclax, or PI3 kinase inhibitor? So really, for patients discontinuing covalent BTK inhibitors such as acalabrutinib for toxicity reasons other than not progression, data do support that they could be switched to another covalent BTK inhibitor, for example, zanubrutinib. Or data that we have seen from the Bruin study suggests that pirtobrutinib could also be an option in this setting. I also want to highlight that depending on prior therapies and prior treatment-free remissions, venetoclax may be an option. PI3 kinase inhibitors, while treatment options for relapsed CLL, are not our top choice in this setting. So for patients who have intolerance to covalent BTK inhibitors, if this is intolerance to ibrutinib, there is the option and data to support sequencing to a more selective covalent inhibitor such as acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib. There's also the option of sequencing to the non-covalent inhibitor pirtobrutinib in certain circumstances or a venetoclax-based regimen. If acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib are discontinued due to toxicity, one could sequence to an alternative covalent inhibitor depending on the toxicity, or could sequence to pirtobrutinib or venetoclax depending on the patient's prior therapies as well as the toxicity. So this is data that shows that for patients with CLL who are intolerant to ibrutinib, sequencing to acalabrutinib was overall effective and safe. So you see here different reasons for intolerance to ibrutinib, and then patients who were treated subsequently with acalabrutinib, what the experience was. And all in all, many patients either experienced a lower grade AE or the same grade AE, and then no patients experienced a higher grade of the same AE. this is data showing that zanubrutinib is effective in the setting of a bruton or a calbrutinib intolerance. So here you see data from the Bruin study. You can see here that patients who had intolerance as the reason for discontinuation of their prior covalent BTK inhibitor, when they were treated with pirtobrutinib, rarely had recurrence of the prior AE that led to discontinuation of ibrutinib, and the majority of patients had no recurrence of this AE during pirtobrutinib treatment. So here's a case of John with, he's a patient, he's 82 years old with relapsed CLL. He has had several prior treatments, including venetoclax obinutuzumab, followed by zanubrutinib, and then in 2024 has progression and requires subsequent therapy. I will note that he takes omeprazole for GERD. And after discussions with his healthcare team, he decides to pursue pirtobrutinib therapy. And he asks about dosing and potential drug interactions. So for pirtobrutinib, there's no dose adjustment necessary for his omeprazole and pirtobrutinib. There's dose of pirtobrutinib is the standard dose of 200 milligrams daily. So I think this case really highlights that multiple disciplines contribute to CLL management, including counseling over appropriate dosing and drug-drug interactions. And I'm going to highlight here the role of the pharmacist and really helping the medical team to take a look at the patient's other medications and checking whether there's any drug-drug interactions. So for the previous case, we know that patients who are on omeprazole proton pump inhibitor don't need a dose adjustment. But there are some medications, antimicrobial therapies, that may have interactions. And so with each drug that a patient starts, it's important for them to inform their care team and have the care team check for drug-drug interactions. And so here you see the standard dosing for the approved BTK inhibitors in CLL. And you see the currently available dosage forms. So I'll highlight, for example, that acalabrutinib used to have a capsule formulation and now has a tablet formulation. Here you see the, again, covalent and non-covalent approved BTK inhibitors. And here we highlight some of the drug-drug interactions that can come up and how the drug should be adjusted. So now that acalabrutinib is now available in a tablet formulation instead of a capsule formulation, there's no dosage adjustment recommended. And that goes for ibrutinib, zanubrutinib, and pirtobrutinib as well. A copy of this drug-drug interaction chart will be made available. So please download this copy and it can be used to review in the clinic with patients potential drug-drug interactions as a resource. So here's a case of Margaret. She's a 79-year-old patient, and she has treatment-naive CLL, but now has anemia and thrombocytopenia, meeting criteria for initiation of therapy. Her medical history is notable for atrial fibrillation and a history of PJP pneumonia, which developed while she was on prior steroid treatment. Acalabrutinib is recommended for initiation of therapy. So with acalabrutinib, a covalent BTK inhibitor, what is the role of infection prevention and how should we incorporate this into our overall management plan while we prepare for therapy initiation? And would this change if the patient was in the relapse setting and was starting a non-covalent BTK inhibitor? So in general, for patients treated with BTK inhibitors, monitoring for bacterial, viral, fungal, and opportunistic infections is an important part of treating patients. PJP prophylaxis and infection monitoring is recommended for this patient who has a prior history of PJP pneumonia. Similar infection prophylaxis, monitoring, and management principles should be applied when using covalent or non-covalent BTK inhibitors. Here we see some of the principles of safety management in general for BTK inhibitors. So, for example, BTK inhibitors in general should not be given concomitantly with warfarin. For patients who have new onset AFib during therapy, non-warfarin anticoagulation is often recommended in consultation with a cardiologist and monitoring. Hypertension is another frequent AE that may be managed with antihypertensives. And you should monitor patients for signs of bleeding. Importantly, we're focusing on today infection monitoring, as infections are a common toxicity that can arise in patients with CLL, including in patients treated with a BTK inhibitor. So here we see general recommendations from the NCCN guidelines for infection prevention in CLL. So I want to highlight a couple of unique cases here. So for patients treated with certain therapies, for example, PI3 kinase inhibitors, it's vital to use HSV prophylaxis, for example, with acyclovir, and PJP prophylaxis with Bactrim or an equivalent drug. PJP prophylaxis should also be considered, as well as VZV prophylaxis, in patients at increased risk for opportunistic infection and receiving BTK inhibitor therapy. This is, for example, is a patient with a prior history of PJP. Fungal infection might also be a consideration and should be monitored for. In particular, in a patient who has prolonged neutropenia, for example, related to disease, where they're initiating BTK inhibitor therapy. Patients' hepatitis B status should also be checked prior to therapy, and monitoring is recommended, as well as CMV status and prophylaxis for patients at high risk. So, in summary, patients who are at increased risk for opportunistic infections should be considered for prophylaxis during BTK inhibitor therapy. Patients should be monitored and evaluated for fevers and infections, and these infections should be treated appropriately during therapy. You should always check for drug-drug interactions when prescribing antimicrobials. For patients with a history of recurrent infections, I do recommend checking for hypogammaglobulinemia. This can be done through a blood test for IgG, immunoglobulin G, and intravenous immunoglobulin, IVIG, can be given in patients with hypogammaglobulinemia and recurrent sinopulmonary infections. This concludes our question-based assessment on the sequential management of CLL. Please review your learning plan summary before you leave, and I hope you found this activity informative and useful for your practice.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. This activity is developed with our educational partner, CLL Society. This activity is part of a larger curriculum developed in collaboration with CLL Society. For more information about useful point-of-care tools and educational resources that can be shared with your patients and used to encourage collaborative care, please view the other components of this series, as well as the collected CLL Society resources. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/WBS860. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Lilly.